Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how did an anti-Semitic letter inspire a story in a superhero comic book? Dr. Rafael Medoff is a professor of Jewish history and founding director of the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. He's the author of over 20 books on the Holocaust and Jewish history. He also wrote the graphic novel Whistleblowers, which tells the true stories of four heroes who risk their careers, or their lives, to expose the truth about the unfolding Holocaust in the 1930s and 40s. We recently spoke with him about the Wyman Institute and Whistleblowers, and we're including links to those programs on this page. This week he's telling us about his new book, Cartoonists Against Racism. Co-authored with Craig Yeo, it describes a project that tackled the problem in a very unique and imaginative way in the 40s and 50s. The book gives us the history behind the project, and then an introduction to 10 cartoonists and examples of their work. It also includes an index, which is very helpful for those interested in the historical figures and organizations that were in some way related to the subject.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Rafael.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the historical background, could you give us just a brief overview of what the book is about?
It's called Cartoonists Against Racism, subtitle, The Secret Jewish War on Bigotry. It's a book about a little-known campaign by Jewish organizations in the 1940s and 1950s who enlisted comic book artists and cartoonists to create anti-racist educational materials, comic books, posters, political cartoons, both to combat anti-Semitism and to fight bigotry in general. So it's a very interesting story because, you know, today we are debating different strategies for combating anti-Semitism, and this was one kind of unique way to approach it. So the book tells the story of the campaign, but much of the book is an art book. It's the actual art that was created during those years and published throughout the country in various newspapers and other venues.
Before we talk about the book itself, I'd like
to speak a little bit about the background and the history. You say that Richard C. Rothschild was an ad executive who was contacted by the American Jewish Committee in 1938 to find new ways to combat anti-Semitism in the U.S. Why was he chosen?
Well, the American Jewish Committee was looking for somebody who could approach the problem of combating anti-Semitism from a new standpoint. In other words, not just using the traditional behind-the-scenes methods, but someone who knew how to speak to the broader American public. So an advertising executive really was the perfect choice because he was someone who was familiar with different techniques that could be used in advertising anything, in advertising products for purchase or in advertising ideas in this case.
Well, how was his approach different from what had been tried before?
Those who opposed anti-Semitism had never attempted to use artists to fight the problem. The idea of bringing in comic book artists, editorial cartoonists, and other types of artists was a brand new concept that Rothschild introduced to the American Jewish Committee. This had never been tried before. There was no way to know if it would be successful. But the most recent events in Germany, the Kristallnacht pogrom in November 1938, had shocked American Jews, both because of the horrors inflicted upon their brethren in Germany, but also because of the realization that anti-Semitism anywhere, even in the United States, theoretically could lead to mass violence. And so in the spirit of looking for unconventional ways to approach a radically escalating problem, the American Jewish Committee and Richard Rothschild reached into this novel area of utilizing cartoonists and comic book artists.
Did they only deal with anti-Semitism or other kinds of bigotry as well?
Well, this actually reflects a debate that continues to this day. As you know, there are those who advocate fighting anti-Semitism by submerging it among all other types of racism and bigotry. In other words, universalizing it and talking about all forms of racism rather than singling out anti-Semitism. And then, of course, there are those who advocate the opposite, to focus exclusively on anti-Jewish discrimination and not on other types of bigotry. Rothschild and the American Jewish Committee were looking for a middle path. And so what you see in the cartoons and comics that are reprinted in Cartoonists Against Racism, typically the posters and the leaflets and the comic book stories that they created would tackle both anti-Semitism and other forms of racism at the same time, in the very same cartoons and the very same storylines.
You said that there was a problem with Hollywood agreeing to participate. Why was that?
There were many Hollywood producers and directors, some of them assimilated Jews, who were nervous about drawing attention to Jews in American society, and who thought that talking about anti-Semitism might somehow make it worse. And so they were not always cooperative in different campaigns against anti-Semitism. And that was true to some extent as well in the campaign that we discuss in Cartoonists Against Racism. But we also explain how from time to time, Rothschild's team was able to find areas of cooperation. So for example, they were able to persuade the producers of the very popular Superman radio show to use a 16 part storyline, which Rothschild and his colleagues helped draft, in which Superman fought against the Ku Klux Klan. So this was a unique way of bringing America's most popular superhero character into the real world, so to speak, by having him take on the bigots who at that very moment were rampaging through the American South, lynching African Americans and causing all sorts of other mayhem.
I don't know if they did this sort of thing in those days, but do you have any idea what effect all of this had on the different groups that were exposed to these messages, these anti-bigotry messages? For example, readers of different kinds of media or adults and children, did they study that kind of thing in those days?
The study of bigotry was a relatively new field in American sociology and political science. So it wasn't something that was yet understood in great depth. On the other hand, at the very moment that Rothschild's team was fighting against racism, America was, of course, going through a racial upheaval. The civil rights movement that began in earnest after World War II was then becoming a major force in American society. So what was being played out in the streets of America was something that was very real to all Americans. The images of state troopers blocking racists from preventing little African American girls from attending school, or police violence against civil rights protesters, or of the lynchings and bombings of black churches in the 1940s and 1950s, this was a very real and escalating crisis in American society. So in a sense, everyone was talking about it. Even if the experts didn't yet have a handle on how best to combat it, this was a problem that was captivating American society in the 1940s and 1950s when Rothschild and his team were trying to tackle the problem in their own unique way.
But they didn't, let's say, have a study of how much people were affected, let's say, by radio programs or by comic books or things like that. They didn't actually study how all of these things were received.
The impact of the Rothschild cartoon and comics campaign was very difficult to measure. One thing we can say with confidence is that if you distribute millions of pamphlets and posters put up in union halls, and cartoons are published in newspapers read by millions of people, and especially if these cartoons and comic books were used as they were in classrooms from coast to coast, that they must have had some impact. It's not possible to determine how much of an impact. Rothschild himself was very optimistic in his assessment. He discussed the campaign and its ramifications some years later. Looking back at it, he was convinced that it had a significant impact. But certainly, we can say that American society changed a great deal in terms of race relations in the 1960s and 1970s. In the election of an African American president and his re-election in more recent years certainly is a testimony to the great improvements in attitudes towards race in America in recent decades. Now, were the seeds for that change planted in part by these millions of posters and comic book stories and political cartoons in the 40s and 50s? It's hard to say, but it seems unlikely that this mass campaign by the Rothschild team would not have had at least some effect, because boys and girls growing up in the 1950s were seeing a lot of these cartoon images in classroom materials. They were reading some of them in very popular comic books that were standard reading for American youngsters. And it's likely that all of this had some impact, although measuring how much impact is not really possible.
Do you think that this kind of approach was easier before there was social media because there was fewer media and it could be better controlled?
Well, you had different factors at work then. To begin with, the popular skepticism or cynicism that we see so much of today, the accusations of fake news, everybody pointing a finger at everybody else and accusing them of lying, of fabricating, of cheating. Those things were not typical of American culture, American political culture back in those days. So when cartoonists or comic book writers and artists were tackling issues of anti-Semitism and racism in those days, they didn't face those kinds of attacks. But they were up against deep-seated prejudices in American society, prejudices which, of course, long predated the advent of electronic media, the internet, and so forth. So Rothschild and his team were up against formidable obstacles in the sense that racism, segregation, and anti-Semitism were extremely widespread in those days. So they had their work cut out for them. What they could not anticipate was that even as racism has been in retreat now for many years in America, they could not anticipate that anti-Semitism would reemerge and from completely different sources than the ones that Rothschild and his team were combating in the 1940s and 1950s.
Something that I found interesting was that the American Jewish Committee's anti-bigotry campaign specifically didn't include Japanese Americans. This was, of course, during the war. But the book includes a speech by Bill Mauldin, who was basically a cartoonist, but he gave the speech in 1945 against bigotry at home, that is, in the States, which did include bigotry against Japanese Americans, especially by certain specific politicians. And you mentioned that this has validity now.
Sadly, there was very little public opposition to President Franklin Roosevelt's order to intern more than 130,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. And in those days, there was very little recognition that the interned Japanese Americans deserved any kind of reparations or apology or recognition of what they had so unjustly suffered. The American Jewish Committee, like other American Jewish organizations, said very little about the mistreatment of Japanese Americans during and after World War II. And that was an unfortunate chapter in American Jewish history in which too many Jewish groups, like many other Americans, simply went along with FDR's unjust order and paid no attention to discrimination against Asian Americans after the war. However, as you note, in Cartoonists Against Racism, we bring up the interesting fact that Rothschild's team did circulate this booklet by the very popular wartime cartoonist Bill Mauldin, in which he had several cartoons alluding to discrimination against Japanese American World War II veterans. During the war itself, almost no political cartoonists, editorial cartoonists, almost none of them challenged the internment of the Japanese Americans. But Mauldin was among the courageous few who, after the war, did take on the subject of discrimination against GIs of Asian descent, who, when returning from the battlefields abroad, faced racist discrimination here in the United States. In general, the problem of anti-Asian discrimination has not received a lot of attention in American society over the years. It was not until the 1980s that the U.S. government, this was under President Ronald Reagan, formally acknowledged the injustice of the mass internment of the Japanese Americans and paid them a very small token compensation. And to this day, it's the subject of racism against Asian Americans is neglected, and which is particularly disturbing because, as you know, there has been a significant upsurge in anti-Asian racism in the United States in recent years, especially following the outbreak of the COVID pandemic.
Before we get to the book itself, can you briefly tell us a little bit about the role of the labor movement and the unions? Because they were allies of this anti-bigotry movement.
Richard Rothschild's team correctly saw the labor unions as a vehicle for spreading their message against anti-Semitism and racism. So a lot of the materials that are reproduced in Cartoonists Against Racism, a lot of the artwork, was featured on posters which were distributed free by the American Jewish Committee, free to labor unions all around the country, to be put up in labor union meeting halls and to be reprinted in labor newspapers. This was a very important way of reaching average American working men and women, so that they would get used to the idea that racism was a violation of American principles and values, and that anti-Semitism was something that every decent person should reject. In combating bigotry, part of the agenda has to be to make it the new normal for average people to become accustomed to the idea that there's something wrong about anti-Semitism and other forms of racism. So the labor unions and meeting halls and publications were an excellent medium for reaching the masses of American workers.
Okay, let's talk about the book. What time period does it cover and which media?
The anti-racism campaign undertaken by Rothschild and his team began shortly after the Kristallnacht pogrom, which was November 1938. They began producing these anti-racism cartoons and comic books in earnest in the early 1940s and continued their efforts all the way up until the early 1960s. So we're talking about two decades of Rothschild and his colleagues working to saturate American popular culture with these images against anti-Semitism and racism. So it went on for many years. It received very generous funding from the American Jewish Committee, but significantly, the American Jewish Committee itself never wanted to be associated with the campaign. They thought that it would be more effective if these cartoons and comics were seen as coming from sources other than the Jewish community itself. So as you'll see in the many cartoons and posters and comic book stories reprinted in the book, Cartoonists Against Racism, the American Jewish Committee is never listed as the sponsor of the materials that it was funding and spreading throughout the United States.
You mentioned radio, and I was wondering, since this went through the 1950s, if television was also included, because I remember from when I was a little kid, on television there were these little commercials with little cartoon characters singing and dancing, and they were anti-racist. You can get good milk from a brown-skinned cow. You remember that? Or as the peach
Yes.
pit, as the peach pit said to the apple core, the color of our skin doesn't matter anymore.
There was an effort, but it was fairly minimal, to use the new medium of television in this campaign. I emphasize the word new. It was still a time in the 1950s when not many Americans yet had televisions in their homes. It was, in other words, television was becoming big in the 50s, but it was a gradual process, and the Rothschild team did not focus on television yet. Radio and especially print media and newspapers were the preferred media for transmitting their messages. You can still find today on YouTube some of those early animated shorts, like the one which you mentioned, in which racism was confronted in very interesting and creative ways. But again, it was early in those days. Television animation were not yet the major forces in communication that they became in later years.
Aside from the single-page cartoons, the book includes two stories, Green Llama, which you said was inspired by a letter, and They Got the Blame, which is about scapegoating. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how they happened to be written?
So Green Llama was a very popular superhero comic book in the 1940s and into the 1950s. That's Llama, L-A-M-A, not alluding to the animal llama. It's a strange name, but an interesting storyline, and it was a very popular superhero. Today, we don't remember the name of the Green Llama. We remember Superman and the other better known figures from that period. But Green Llama was in 1945, was the setting for a very interesting story inspired by Rothschild's campaign. What happened is that the Rothschild group had placed a full page newspaper ad in a number of major American newspapers, which showed American GIs from all ethnic backgrounds, that is, with stereotypical names, Kelly, Cohen, Svoboda. It showed all of them equally sacrificing on the battlefields in World War II. That ad appeared in an issue of Green Llama, as it was placed both in newspapers and comic books and another print media. The ad triggered an anti-Semitic letter to the editors of the comic book. They retaliated, in effect, by then creating a comic book story in which the Green Llama confronts the bigots who wrote that letter. So it was an interesting kind of inside baseball episode. The other comic book story that we reprint also in full color was an educational comic strip. It was called They Got the Blame, and it was published in a very popular a comic book called True Comics, which had a circulation of about 500,000 each month, and which showcased stories about real people and real historical events. So it wasn't a superhero comic. It was a different kind of approach to using comic book style illustration to teach about, you know, real history and real current events. The story, They Got the Blame, is a kind of interesting summary of different events in history where people were scapegoated, sometimes Jews, sometimes other minority groups. But it had the same purpose and the same message as the editorial cartoons and the posters in the labor union halls, etc. The message that anti-Semitism and all racism is un-American, and that America stands for fairness to all people, regardless of their race or creed, and that bigotry should be rejected. It's obviously important for children to be reading those kinds of stories. In those days, typical comic book readers were, you know, ages 10 to 12. That changed a lot in more recent years. But in those days, comic books were very much children's reading material. And it was important for young boys and girls to be taking in those kinds of anti-racism messages at an early stage of life before they would potentially become influenced by a lot of the prejudice that they might encounter in the society around them.
The book has notes after many of the cartoons giving context, and in several footnotes you mentioned that the language sounds very contemporary, either the actual language of the bigotry itself, like Americans versus foreigners, and also you make a connection to current events as you mentioned, about Asian Americans being considered foreigners and who were attacked because of COVID. And also, in some of these cartoons, there are specific political leaders of the 1940s who are referenced, especially in the Don't Listen to Him series. And you also relate them to what is happening now. Can you comment on that?
One of the more disturbing aspects of creating this book that my co-author Craig Yeo and I discovered was how much the events of the 40s and 50s and this anti-racism campaign, how much they have in common with our own times. One would like to think that society is much more enlightened today. And in many ways, of course, it is. American society in 2024 is not the same as, let's say, 1954 or 1964. I've mentioned the election and re-election of an African-American president. We have a black vice president. Segregation, which was so common back in those days, has been roundly defeated, and racism in general has been deeply discredited. And yet, again and again, when we looked at some of the editorial cartoons and other illustrations that we reprint in Cartoonists Against Racism, we were struck by certain echoes. But the major difference between then and now is, of course, the massive eruption of anti-Semitism in the past year, and also in recent years, but especially in the past year following the October 7th Hamas invasion of Israel. This is something that Richard Rothschild and his team could not have imagined. A lot of their efforts in the 40s and 50s focused on anti-Semitism coming from the far right. They did not expect that a few decades later it would all be coming from the far left. But it's just another disturbing reminder of how, as much as things change, unfortunately, sometimes things don't change as much as they should. And so the struggle against bigotry, which Rothschild and the American Jewish Committee so nobly undertook back then, is in many ways an unending struggle.
Something that I found interesting, and this is almost like an inversion of what we're talking about, is that one of the cartoons talked about how this racist, this bigot, wanted a doctor to be of his own ethnicity. And in the footnote, you say that contemporary patients often want doctors of the same ethnicity. I recently saw a report about Black patients, especially women, being discriminated against by white doctors, especially pregnant women, and there seemed to be more complications and mortality if they are not treated by Black doctors and midwives.
There's no doubt that such attitudes are far less common today than they used to be. But sadly, we still have remnants of that kind of prejudice, even in the world of medicine, where the most basic obligation of every doctor is to treat all patients equally. So it's heartbreaking when we hear of instances of this kind of bigotry. Just recently, there were reports in the news about medical practitioners, I believe psychiatrists or other mental health professionals, who were saying that they would refuse to treat what they call Zionists. So whether it's discrimination against Jews or, as you noted, instances of discrimination against African Americans, this is still a problem. And so it's as important as ever for good people to come together and to combat these kinds of very disturbing trends.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we might have left out?
Well, we're in an election year in the United States. We're going to be electing a president in a few months. And as readers of Cartoonists Against Racism will see, the problem of extreme passions and prejudices seems to come up, especially in heated political seasons, such as presidential years. We have in Cartoonists Against Racism a series of cartoons that Rothschild and his team commissioned from the editorial cartoonist Eric Godal in 1944 in order to discredit prejudice and bigotry in that year's presidential campaign. I expect that we will find some of our contemporary cartoonists likewise taking on the problem of bigotry in this year's campaign. So as I say, it's a problem that we have to be on guard against constantly. Craig Yeo, my co-author, and I are grateful to Dark Horse and Yeo Books for publishing Cartoonists Against Racism. I hope that there will not be a need for a second volume, but as a historian, I know that unfortunately, sometimes these topics need to be addressed again and again so that we can all learn from history.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSephirod.com. See you next week.